what I'm seeing, an epidemic of issues around sleep, chronic stress-related issues, increasingly at a young age. It is absolutely vital for our individual well-being and for our more collective well-being, and that's a whole other discussion, that we are having this skill so that we can be in balance and we can be rested and we can be clear and we can be perceptive and able to give our best and be our best.
I'm Dr. Linda Papadopoulos, and this is The Psychology Behind. And that voice that you just listened to is Gillian Lavender, who is a brilliant Ayurvedic teacher. She's a meditation teacher. She's a Vedic wellness practitioner. And we had an absolutely wonderful chat about meditation, about Gillian's journey to finding it, which was fascinating, but also about the science behind it, which I thought was, you know, particularly interesting. So I really hope that you enjoy this podcast. I certainly enjoyed it. And with no further ado, I give you Gillian Lavender. I'm always excited about my guests, but I think this one was that, you know, that word serendipity, when you've been thinking of something and then somehow, I don't know, fates have it or just luck has it. And Gillian reached out and said, Linda, you know, we spoke a while back and I'd love to come in and chat something that I've been thinking about, which is meditation. Now, Gillian is absolutely brilliant. She is the co-founder of the London and New York Meditation Center. She's an expert Vedic wellness practitioner. She's an Vedic meditation teacher. She writes about this. She talks about this. She walks the walk and she talks the talk. And today we have her here to ask all those burning questions. Because I've got to say, I'm always, as you, anyone who listens to this podcast knows, I'm a bit of a nerd, right? I like my science. It's all well and good to, you know, to say things work, but, you know, where are the numbers? Where are the stats? So one of the things I've been looking at recently is the science behind this. And I think Gillian is very well placed to answer questions. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
I'm delighted that you're here. So I guess the best place to start is right at the beginning for our listeners who don't know. What is meditation?
I think it's such a good question because there's so much misunderstanding about meditation. I think one of the great things is that we're in a stage now where meditation is much more mainstream. You know, I was in a black cab the other day and I was chatting to this guy and he's like, what do you do? You know, that question. And I said, I teach meditation. And he had some awareness and some understanding and he knew quite a lot about this. And I think it's fascinating. I think that is a double-edged sword because with that expansion and going a little bit more mainstream, it has the potential to dilute what meditation actually is. And, you know, sometimes people will come to me and they'll say, well, I've tried meditation and it didn't work. And actually what they were trying would not be what I would classify as meditation. Mm-hmm. So I teach the oldest technique of meditation that we have on the planet. It's called Vedic meditation, V-E-D-I-C. Vedic means of the Veda. And Veda refers to a body of knowledge which is anywhere from 5 to 10,000 years old. The oldest body of knowledge that we have. And it's where we get Ayurveda, this ancient system of healthcare, yoga, meditation, all this comes from there. And in essence, what meditation is a simple, natural mental technique which allows us to de-excite the mind and step beyond activity and beyond thinking to arrive at the baseline of consciousness. Pure consciousness, the source of all of our thinking. And that has a very direct impact on our physiology because, as you know, as is the mind, so is the body. And for every mental state, there's a corresponding state in the physiology. So when I'm teaching, I'm making a distinction between mind and body. Although from one point of view, one could say, well, it's all one thing. Because we know that you are what you think. You're printing that out in your physiology. But this is what meditation is. It's this ability to de-excite and most importantly, to do so in a way which is natural and easy. And I think this is something, you know, there are so many, I call them these meditation myths, and we kind of need to start unpicking these. And one of the most common ones is, oh, God, I could never sit there for 20 minutes. You know, meditation is just, how am I going to settle down my mind? You know, and the moment I try to make it more quiet, I end up in the spiral of now I'm thinking about this and I'm thinking about, oh, I shouldn't be thinking, and, you know, come back to the breathing or focus on the candle flame or whatever it is, you know, and you end up in this sort of loop of I mustn't think. And the very thing that I mustn't do, I'm doing more of.
Which, of course, is at the basis of anxiety. So when I treat people with anxiety, it becomes a fear of fear. I get anxious about being anxious, and so I'm anxious, right?
Yeah.
So a big part of the way that I would approach it as a psychologist who kind of uses cognitive therapy would be to take away its power by saying, well, what's it going to do? What's the anxiety? Let's look at it. Let's actually feel the anxiety. Now, how does that, I don't know, how as someone who does meditation, how would you approach that kind of, that idea of like, I can't do this because I have to do this?
Well, I think when they learn Vedic meditation, they learn that when we work with the nature of the mind, it is actually ridiculously easy to settle down the mind. And the only thing, this is fascinating, the only thing that we can do wrong when practicing Vedic meditation is to try to meditate. So it is an effortless technique. Now that kind of feels a bit counter, well, how can it be effortless? The key to this is the way that we, or the device that we use to settle down the mind. So what happens in Vedic meditation is you sit down comfortably in a chair with back support and you close the eyes and you introduce a sound into the mind, and it's a very particular sound. We call it a mantra. Man comes from the Sanskrit root manas, which means mind. Tra is where we get our English word traction. Tractor. Something's attractive, I'm going to move towards it. If something's distracting, I'm going to move away from it. Traction. So the mantra is a very particular vibration which is chosen for you by the teacher. Not everybody has the same mantra. Is a mind vehicle. And these mantras, these bij mantra, means seed mantra, when we think it silently in the mind, it automatically self-refines and becomes spontaneously more soft and more faint and more subtle.
So can I ask, is it about the sound or is it about the meaning of the word? Because I can,
Very good question.
Yeah, yeah. I, my work in psychoneuroimmunology, for example, right? If I was to get you to think of a really negative, awful word, like death, or hate, or I don't know, something. As happy as you are, it's not necessarily about the sound, but it's the meaning. Likewise, it'll affect you. So yeah, how does that work?
Absolutely, it's a great question. So it's a meaningless sound.
Okay.
So if I gave you, your sound was flower, 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 you know, oh gosh, I need to get some flowers, and oh, you know, it's Valentine's Day, and oh, why didn't I get any flowers? And do you know, da-di-da, we attribute literal or connotative meaning to that word. What we use in Vedic meditation is a sound. It's the vibrational quality which is resonant with your nervous system, which is also a vibration of energy.
Sure.
So as this mantra spontaneously becomes softer and fainter, it pulls the mind into these super subtle layers of the mind. And then, interestingly, it does its last little trick, and it disappears. And for a moment, the meditator's mind falls mute. It falls quiet. And we, in meditation jargon, we call this transcending. Transcend means step beyond. If I transcend something, I've stepped beyond it. We transcend activity. We transcend thinking, which is also a more subtle aspect of activity, to arrive at the baseline of who we are, a state of being, because I'm not a human doing or a human thinking. I'm a human being. And that is the source of me and everything in the universe. We talk about quantum field theory. We refer to this vacuum state, this unified field aspect of nature from which everything is manifesting. And Vedic meditation is an easy, natural way to take the mind to that subtle inner reservoir. And most importantly, that process is happening through the utilization of the what it is that the mind wants. So the moment that I try not to think, I end up thinking more. Now, what's happening to the mantra is as it becomes more refined, it becomes increasingly charming to the mind. It's just like nectar. It's delicious, more delicious, more delicious, more delicious. And the mind just goes for it. It's like, you know, if someone starts playing your favorite song out there, oh gosh, that's love. You know, mind just goes there.
But that then suggests that there's going to be individual differences, or is there like a unified mantra for people? So how would someone find their mantra?
By going to a teacher who knows how to teach. And so it's not any old sound. It's not it's not. So part of my job as a teacher is to be able to allocate the right sound to the individual. There are not 7 billion sounds, because I wouldn't remember them, but there are certain sounds which work best for certain groups of people.
And how do you decide that? Like, what do you
based kind of... on a number of criteria. So psychophysiological type, in Ayurveda we call it the mind-body type. Life stage has an impact on it. And interestingly, the stage that society is in over time, in a more macro sense, can have an impact of what mantras are used. So there are a number of factors, and it's
not
a
would it be worth doing it together now to have our listeners see how that would work with me, or is it something that would take a long time?
No, that bit must be private.
That's interesting as well. So the privacy, is that about kind of, I guess, like a therapy session? So you want people to kind of open up about sort of deeper issues?
No, not at all. Okay. No, it's just that moment is a private one. When I whisper that mantra to you, you whisper it back to me, and then I teach you how to use it. And that always happens privately, not because there's anything essentially weird going on, but there's a way of us maintaining the purity of this knowledge. And it's a process that one goes through to receive that knowledge. And we like to just keep that private. And because not everybody has the same sound, and we don't want to undermine the power of this. This sound is incredibly, I always say to people, it's like your new best friend, you know, because you've got it and you sit down and what this is going to do for your mind and your body is so profound. Mm-hmm. And so we take care around this. Mm-hmm. It's something that we must have some respect for this. And I find in the people that I'm teaching, absolutely, they come with that. There's a readiness, there's an openness, there's a curiosity, there's a sense that something very important is happening in that moment.
But before they come with that, they come with questions, they come with anxieties, because there's, you know, we both know in this whole area of wellness, there's people that are doing some amazing things, but there's a lot of charlatanism. I mean, you literally go online. Before you came in, did a bit of research, and there's hundreds of thousands of people online, some I'm sure doing great stuff, but some sort of professing very kind of, you know, I don't think these things are necessarily grounded in so much evidence or science. So how does one find their way around this?
I think you're right. I think there's a lot of stuff that is confusing. There's a lot of stuff that perhaps potentially could lead somebody down a path that actually was not so helpful. You know, when I'm working with people and people are showing a level of interest in meditation, what we do is we ask them to come to an introductory talk and meet us. We don't teach meditation over the internet. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a process that must happen face to face. And they come to an introductory talk, they meet us, they learn about the science behind this, they learn about the benefits, they learn how practical and easy and doable it is for modern life, and then they're in a position to make an informed decision. And I think there is something in that process, and you will know this from the relationship and the care that you take about the work that you're doing with your clients, is that relationship is a very important one, and there must be a sense of trust and resonance. There's something I can learn something from this person. There's some connection there, and it's a subtle thing sometimes. And I think it's important when we're receiving such powerful knowledge that we feel safe and we feel, yes, this person knows what they're doing. We commit to teaching this in a very particular way, in the way that it was designed to be taught over, you know, many generations. And so I think one must do that research and find that connection and go with what resonates and it's often there are stepping stones to getting to that point. You know, you might be trying something and then you think, oh, yeah, this is interesting, but I feel like there could be something more. Yeah. And so often people come to us, you know, I've done the app or I've done this.
Well, that's what I was going to say, you know. Because I think we also live in a time where we want it now, we want it quick. Yeah. And there's a lot of promises. Oh, yes, you know, watch this 3-minute video and you will be, well, maybe we can do this by kind of looking at some of the signs behind it. Maybe we can dispel some of this. So tell me, why should we be meditating?
Because to not have an experience whereby we can rest deeply and release stress is going to leave us out of balance emotionally and physically. So what meditation is doing is it's giving us a balancing effect to all of this doing and all of this activity and all of this thinking. You know, it's too much thinking. Everybody is pulled out and technology is doing it and we're on all the time. And that's great in one sense, in that we as human beings are, as householders who are living in the world, who have relationships, who have jobs, you know, who want to achieve and enjoy success. You know, we're not sitting in a cave in the Himalaya. It's about being out there. And so what are the tools that you have in your toolbox that allow you to be well and balanced and clear and free from some of the emotional manifestations of stress and physical manifestations of stress? Mm-hmm. It's all intertwined. So I think in this age of what I'm seeing, an epidemic of issues around sleep, chronic stress-related issues, increasingly at a young age, it is absolutely vital for our individual well-being and for our more collective well-being, and that's a whole other discussion, that we are having this skill so that we can be in balance and we can be rested and we can be clear and we can be perceptive and conscious and able to give our best and be our best. And that's what everybody wants.
Of course, absolutely. And I think it's great you've touched on a lot of actually well-founded psychological benefits, but as well, psychophysiologically, there's some really interesting research. Yeah. So a few of the papers that I've read obviously speak to the frontal lobe becoming much more, you kind of see the gray matter increasing there. But interestingly enough, in that older part of the brain where anxiety lay, you actually see a reduction there, which to me is fascinating, because I think there is... You're absolutely right. The World Health Organization has released data on this as well. We definitely, in terms of mental health, are in crisis here, right? Yeah. It's happening at a younger age. It's happening across an increase across almost all age groups. And I think there's something about, you know, psychologists often talk about depression, about, you know, something about, you know, living in the past, and anxiety about living in the future. So I think what you do very much is about being in the present, right? Mm. So I wonder if you could speak a little bit to what happens in the brain when we meditate. What are some of the stats that we understand about that?
I just find this so fascinating. It just dovetails so much with what you're saying and what the work that you do, because, you know, our brain is constantly changing. We talk about this, you know, the malleability, the neuroplasticity, you know, what you do with your brain changes it. So you learn a musical instrument, you learn another language, you learn to juggle, you know, you're asking your brain, you're asking those interneuronal connections to develop. Now, when somebody practices Vedic meditation, we see a very particular brain signature within minutes. So what is happening, many things are happening, the type of brain waves that are forming, a lot of alpha brainwave activity, but particularly what's, I think, so important is this, what we see is this high degree of activity in the prefrontal cortex. Now, the prefrontal cortex is commonly known as the CEO of the brain because it governs it's your executive processing center. Yeah. It's the higher functioning of the human system. And this becomes very engaged, very active in the meditator through a 20-minute sitting of meditation, which is what we do, 20 minutes. And we can see it on the EEG. We can see it very, very clearly. And what we also see is a very high degree of coherence between left and right hemisphere of the brain, talking in a very orderly, coordinated way, which is associated with these peak moments of creativity. And when we look at subsequent results on creativity tests, on learning ability, on memory, both short and long term, concentration, what we see is that this optimization of brain functioning is what's leading to these kinds of results. And because of that malleability, because of that plasticity, we know in longitudinal studies that that normalizes, that becomes the new normal, rather than us relying on a brain which is not engaging in the way that is helpful. You know, when we want to make a good decision, I absolutely want my prefrontal cortex to be engaged. However, the interesting thing is, and I was reading a study about this of US college students, and they looked at what happened to the prefrontal cortex in particular when they were very tired and very stressed. And essentially, it goes offline. It's like that shuts down, and now they're in that very old part of the brain, yeah, which is not what we want to be governing our decision making. And, you know, those base emotions of fear and anger, that are, that's not where we want to be stationed. So absolutely, meditation changes the brain.
And are the results something that last? And is there research around how much one needs to be meditating to gain the results and for how long?
These changes start immediately. So we'll see it in the 20 minutes. However, over time, over, you know, a period, a number of years, not so many, what we'll see is the stabilization of that brain functioning outside of meditation. In the beginning, it's an eyes closed dependent phenomenon. Mm-mm. Over time, that becomes the new normal. And, you know, as you know, in the work that you're doing, you know, we've seen studies on, I remember a study on black cab drivers, you know, using their brain, and this was before GPS, of course, you know, using your brain in a certain way changes the size
of certain neurons that fire together wire together, right? Yeah. So we know that we understand a lot more about you're absolutely right about neuron plasticity. And actually, for as someone who's worked with CBT for a long time, it's interesting. I'm hearing you talk and I'm saying, well, this is the kind, we didn't know why it was working, but it was working, right? So what you do when someone comes in is you get them to retrain what they focus on. So maybe it's not meditation, but instead of walking around and thinking that the world is out to get me, you focus on something positive. What am I grateful for? It can be something small. It doesn't have to be something big, but you do that often enough and your brain begins to seek that out rather than seeking out why there's something to be afraid of, why there's something to worry about. So in a lot of ways, it does kind of, you know, we've known this stuff and now we're kind of trying to, well, we're figuring out why it works. I'm really interested in this idea of decision-making because you're absolutely right. So when the CEO and sort of, you know, we have a problem with a prefrontal, you know, that sort of, it's the overload, it becomes really hard. Now, I see it a lot with anxiety. I see it a lot with depression. I'll sit across from people who, you know, normally very high functioning, will say to me, Linda, I literally sat in front of like the sandwich store and I couldn't decide which sandwich to pick up. And and I, that to me always rings those alarm bells. Can you speak to that a bit around?
Yes. And in my teaching and in my work, the angle that I come from with this is essentially from the point of view that when one is tired and when one is stressed, one is never going to make their best decisions. Mm-hmm. You're never going to make your best decisions when you're tired and cranky. Mm-hmm. It just ain't going to happen, you know, because what's happening is that you are in reaction mode. And in that state of feeling overwhelmed, feeling tired, and having all of that stress chemistry coursing through the system, one is having a stress reaction. Now, stress is always going to cause us to do the opposite of what is required in that moment, of the opposite of what is most appropriate. Mm-hmm. It's interesting. I was just talking about this with a journalist the other day because she was interviewing me around, you know, with some of the political things that are going on and all this uncertainty. Yeah, how is this affecting things? And it was an interesting discussion because, you know, often we think that stress is something that's going to create a more sort of aggressive or overreactive, or, you know, we get snappy, or actually there's another side to it, which is actually the paralyzing effect that stress can have. We just are so overwhelmed, we cannot even make a decision. Like, do I eat that or do I have that? You know, it's like, and the thing is, we are making decisions every day. life is all about making choices. And if you are tired and if you are stressed, you're probably going to make less good choices. And it's as simple as that. So what I do is I help people to release the tiredness and release the stress. It's fundamental to what's happening when you meditate. And when you clear out those obstructions, the nervous system is then balanced and free of those obstructions, and clarity is there, consciousness is available, and the nervous system isn't all stirred up by the anxiety and the tension and the fear, you know, the irritation, all of these things which are getting in the way of us being able to make good decisions.
Indeed. And again, psychophysiologically, with decision making, there's differences between men and women, we know, right? So I remember looking at some really interesting research after the crash in 2008. And one of the things that we know is that when men become more stressed and anxious, they actually become much more risk-taking. So even as they lose, they're more likely to go all in. Now that's very, so I kind of think, you know, we believe we're these rational creatures, but actually we are at the mercy of our hormones and our physiology and the thoughts that we think. And one of the things that I say time and time again on this podcast, our thoughts are not intangible things. You know, you cannot be walking around with a thought, whether it be I'm not good enough or the world owes me or the world's out to get me, and expect, you know, things to come back. And I'm not particularly a religious person, so I don't, you know, necessarily ascribe to ideas of karma per se, but I think it makes sense to me that if you're going to walk around and put out negativity, be unkind, be stressed, it's obviously, it's just a matter of reciprocity going to come back to you.
And absolutely. I totally agree. I was just talking about this the other night. I was giving a talk to some of our students about, you know, what you put your attention on grows. You know, it's so basic. And like will attract like. And so if you're giving tension, let's not be surprised if you get a whole lot of tension coming back. You know, it's always this relationship, and you use the word so beautifully, it's reciprocity. In nature, it's there all the time. And in relationship, which is so core to who we are, we're all in relationship. Yeah. You know, what you give, you get. If you want kindness, give kindness. If you want attention, give attention. And if we go into relationships and we're needy and we're desperate and we are worn out and we don't feel well, let's not be surprised at what's happening. And so, you know, I always say, you know, what we give, it's so fundamental to the nature of that relationship. And it's our responsibility, you know, ours. And that's where I think, as I'm coming back to our earlier conversation, why having the kinds of knowledge that you're showing people and the kinds of techniques that I'm teaching people is so important, because we need these tools in our toolkit more than ever.
Absolutely. You touched on something that I'm really interested in as well, this idea of generosity. I think generosity and kindness are actually, and I'm not talking again, like I'm not kumbaya talking in cat posters, but you know, there's something really profound about, can I do something for you? Or, you know, do you need this? Not what am I going to get out of it? So I really want to make the point about reciprocity. I don't think the idea is that you do something good to necessarily get something back. But there's something, because we are joined, we're social creatures, we evolve to be in groups. You know, we've got, you know, billions of years of evolution in every one of our cells. That means we shouldn't just be looking out for number one, right? It doesn't work like that. So I think I really picked up on that from what you were saying, this idea of giving, right? There being something
important. Yeah, but I think it's hard to give something of value when you're a bit of a stress bag and you're tired, because then it's all, you know, it is me consciousness. Mm. How do I get through this management meeting? How do I get through this day? How do I deal with this tricky situation with, you know, these people or whatever it is that I'm facing? And then we're on the back foot and we're in survival mode. And then I'm not actually in a capacity to give those things of value, because I'm trying to simply get through my day and I'm in reaction mode. And I think it's fundamental to who we are as human beings that we have the capacity to communicate. You know, communicate means com means with, and unity, you know, have mm-hmm. that unity. That's what communication is. However, if we are not in a good place, that is going to undermine what it is that we're giving and how valuable that is to the others. And so this is where it really comes back to taking care about yeah. and being in a position where we can give something of value, and giving our stressy, tired self is never going to be
absolutely
that, you know, desirable.
Giving something of value. It's again, it's about not just time, but time well spent, right? And again, there's study after study about productivity, and people think that burning out or this competitive, like, I take no holidays, I'm the first one at the office and the last one to leave. Actually, there comes a point where you plateau and then you actually become less productive.
Exactly.
So we're definitely on the same page here today.
Yeah, so this whole sort of, it's cool to be, you know, busy and, you know, it's cool not to sleep. It's cool, you know, all this kind of stuff, which is like, you know, well, you might be able to sustain that for a while, but there's a cost.
At what
there's
cost?
A cost of being stressed. There's a cost of being tired, and it's a cost on your physiology, on your health, on the rate at which you're aging. Mm-hmm. This is all in the research that we
with
see
telomeres.
On,
yeah.
Yeah. On meditation is that we see a slowing down in the aging process. Because there's two different ways of looking at aging. You know, someone's had 35 birthdays and we'd say, right, their chronological age is 35. However, you know, that person might have been living life pretty rough. Their actual biological age, which we're going to measure by a number of different factors, you know, their near point vision, sense of hearing, all these factors that we can look at, you know, might be 45.
Yeah.
What the fascinating research about meditation is that biological age reverses over time. And I think that's very, very interesting because it makes sense. You know, if I'm not wearing down my system and I don't have all of that acidity and, you know, which is corrosive, you know, then I'm not breaking down my system in
the
same way.
Can you explain the acidity?
Well, when we're stressed, our body produces certain neurohormones, the stress chemistry of fight, flight. So cortisol, which, you know, women are producing it in higher rates than men. There's a difference there, as you have touched on earlier. Norepinephrine, which is produced by the adrenal glands, all this stuff is coursing through our system. And, you know, in that moment of fight flight, our body has a tendency to activate that production, which is creating more excitation in the nervous system. You know, but there we are face to face with a saber-toothed cat, and we know what, you know, is happening. The body is hardwired for that moment of fight flight. So activation of all of that biochemistry, and, you know, perhaps there's some undigested food in the tummy. Well, that's not the priority when you're face to face with fight flight moment. So acid starts dumping into the stomach to clear that out. We need to be nimble. We need to move. Our immune system was busy doing, as it is right now, us sitting here, hundreds of vital functions, like fighting viruses, like dealing with overproduction of cells. Now, all that goes on the back burner in that moment of fight flight. And, you know, this is going to wear us down.
Beautifully put.
And so what we want to do is the opposite. Mm. What we want to do is de-excite, rest deeply, and then we can clear out that legacy of stress and tiredness in the body. And then we are healthier and we're younger and we're clearer and we're more able to engage in a way that will be blissful and helpful. And you know.
But it also helps the other basics, right? We speak about Maslow's hierarchy of needs. And I'm always harping on do the basics, sleep well, eat well, move well. This type of meditation will help you sleep better, will help you eat better and move better. And
I think it's a really interesting, you know, someone said to me the other day, oh, you know, you're addicted to this meditation. And I'm like, wait a minute. You know? And because this whole addiction thing, you know, let's not be sloppy in our language here. You know, there are good dependencies and there are not so good dependencies. Everybody is dependent. I'm dependent on water and air and cuddles and good food and rest. And I happen to know how to get very, very good rest very efficiently. Absolutely, I'm dependent on meditation. Mm. You know, And as you just have said, you know, we have these non-negotiables. I don't go through a 24-hour period and normally not eat or sleep or drink some water or meditate. You know, it is up there because I know the value of that for me and my family and my students. You know, it's a non-negotiable. So, yeah, I am. Now, there's the not so good dependencies. Of course, we know what those are. But, yeah, I think, you know, what are those non-negotiables? What are the things that are kind of the pillars, the foundations that are allowing us to be our best?
Indeed, indeed. So everyone who comes on the podcast, because I'm lucky enough to meet people who do really amazing work, and I kind of think in the course of our lives, there are moments that change us. There are comforts that we hold on to. And then there's the compasses that we used to go forward. So I wanted to ask you, firstly, what was that sort of seminal moment for you in your life that kind of gave you, well, maybe transcendence, as you say, or clarity?
Yeah. Well, I think the big moment, it was learning to meditate because it, and I'm showing my age here, but it happened, 24 years ago. I was very young and I was working in a business. I had been employed to set up this company and I knew nothing about meditation. I was not into yoga. I was working very hard across different time zones. I was traveling a lot internationally. I was based in Sydney. Sydney's a long way from everywhere. I was sort of dealing with jet lag. And I'd really been thrown in the deep end work-wise. And I found out about meditation through a friend, his father, actually, who was an insomniac and had tried so many different things and nothing had stuck and nothing had really worked. And then he learned to meditate, learned Vedic meditation, and he started sleeping really quickly, like within days and weeks. And I was like, whoa, this is interesting, because I was always tired. And partly because of the jet lag, but partly because of my lifestyle, my issue was not that I couldn't get to sleep, which is a big issue for many people that come to us, or that, you know, waking up at 3 a.m. and you can't get back to sleep. My issue was I was sleeping what I thought was an okay night's sleep, but I would wake up tired. Yeah. You know, I'd be like, oh my God, just pushing that snooze button. And I didn't want to get out of bed. So I learned to meditate based on that recommendation. And, you know, I did go into it feeling a little trepidation because I thought, oh, this could be a little bit brown rice and sandals for me. You know, this is going to be too much. And it was such a relief when I saw my soon-to-be teacher looked, you know, relatively normal. And the science behind it was incredibly reassuring for me, because I'm like you. I like that balancing effect of knowing that. And so I jumped in and I took the course.
Really?
And I started to notice changes straight away. You know, I was waking up before my alarm clock, which never happened. And I was noticing that energy sustaining itself through the day. And I was, I think, really importantly, feeling much less overwhelmed and anxious. I'd been a bit of a worrier. I had a lot on my plate. And what I was noticing was that my response to the demands of my life was changing. And I was more grounded and I was calmer. And so I continued. And just those things compounded, I became much clearer, more able to prioritize. So that was absolutely a moment for me when I felt that there was, you know, it was like a fork in the road. I took a different path and I had access then to knowledge that was changing where I was going and how I was. And then, you know, I ended up becoming a teacher of it. So clearly it was a moment that had a huge impact for me.
Yeah. Amazing. And from that moment, and I'm kind of wondering, we're going to say to this, what is the comfort that you take along with you? Because there's the obvious one, but I'm wondering, is there, we talk about rocks, what do you lean on, or what's your thing?
When I was thinking about what to say for this, and it's funny, in New Zealand, I'm a Kiwi, and we have this great, you're going to wonder where I'm going with this, but we have this great brand of backpacks called MacPacks.
Okay. Yeah?
And, you know, there I was at a stage in my life. I had this huge job. I was late 20s and my 30, just maybe 30. And I'd got to a point relatively early on in my career when I realized that this wasn't it. This wasn't giving me what I felt was going to be the medium to long-term challenge and fulfillment that I was, and so there was something about it that was off, and I took a pretty clear step of resigning. People thought I'd gone absolutely bonkers. They were like, what, you know, you've got to this point and you're walking away from this. And I walked away not knowing what was coming next. And it was interesting because it was a very comfy existence. You know, I had that paycheck coming in every month. I had this lovely lifestyle. I knew when my next sort of strategy meeting and budget, you know, it was all mapped out. And I walked away from it. And like I think many Kiwis, we get that backpack on and we take off. And that's what I did. And I got my backpack on and I had everything in storage. I didn't have a lot of stuff, but I put everything in storage and I took off. And everything that I had was on my back, in my backpack. And I traveled for over a year. And it was very interesting because it was the complete opposite of how I'd been living my life. You know, I'd wake up one morning and I'd meet someone in a cafe and they'd say, oh, no, no, don't go to Venezuela, go to Ecuador. And I'd say, oh, okay, right, you know, I'll go to Ecuador, you know. And I really was living from a place of not knowing, you know, I was sort of falling in love with uncertainty. You know, that was the way I would describe it.
But and, isn't that beautiful, the ability to not only tolerate uncertainty, but to embrace it, right? Because that's the only certainty is uncertainty.
Exactly. It's so true. You know, I always say there's only one constant in life, and that's change. And it taught me just that, you know, that capacity to adapt and go with the flow. And it was in that time that I met up with Tom, my teacher, who'd moved back to the US. And I ended up going to Flagstaff up in the mountains of northern Arizona. And I was hung out there for a year and a half and became a teacher of Vedic meditation. So I went from running a global publishing company to being a teacher of meditation. And it was, you know, with my trusty backpack. And, you know, there's another moment. It is another moment where it changed.
But I love that. I love the... I'm big on identity and what we hang our identity on, the stories that we tell ourselves. And I think this idea, I could imagine, I don't know what this backpack looks like. I'm intrigued now. I'm going to go Google Mac. But there seems something about this idea of movement but containment in the backpack. There's something really beautiful about that. You felt safe enough that all you needed was there.
Yes.
It was what, you know, it was, you were willing to let go. Because again, you know, identity is this interesting thing. Like you said, you were a high powered woman, this amazing job. And the ego, it's hard to let go of that stuff, isn't it? Yeah. But it sounds like when you did, it spoke to not only your bravery, but I think that integrity of being able to define what happy or healthy or good looks like for yourself, which is such a difficult thing to do.
Yeah, because I think I was so defined by the title I had and the money I had and what other people thought of me and how they were rating my performance and all that stuff. Which is so, you know, it's there, it's layer upon layer. And, you know, there was something scary about it, but there's also something kind of liberating about not having a whole lot of stuff around me and not having that. And, you know, it wasn't a smooth ride all the way. I'd be lying if I said, you know, it was bumpy at times. And it was certainly an experience that shaped me. And I think to this point about, you know, we understanding how to be adaptable, because there is one thing we can be guaranteed about, that things are going to continue to change. And if we're rigid and we're inflexible, you know, it's like that thing, you know, if the tree is rigid, it's going to snap. You know, if it's got that flex, it's going to bend. Mm-hmm. It's going to, you know, move with the wind. And, you know, I think about this as a mother and what I'm, you know, trying to bring for my daughter. One of those things I think is around this notion of being adaptable, because, you know, this world is changing fast, you know, and if we don't have that capacity to adapt, it's going to be very, very rough.
Do you know, one of my favorite sort of large-scale studies speaks to adaptability so much. I think it was, I can't remember what kind of firm it was. I think it was an insurance firm, literally thousands of people, and they followed them over a 25-year period. Wow. Now, over this 25 years, people are going to die, they're going to lose their jobs, they're going to get divorced. And what they found was that there was a third of people, like you said, that were not only fine, but bounced back. And again, it's the stories we told ourselves. So two people lost, or three people lose their jobs. Two people get very depressed about it. They think this is says something about me or about the industry, or about, you know, and they get stuck. One of those three people says, do you know what? I've always wanted to fill in the blank, travel the world, start up my own company, you know, retrain as something. And they are able to use those silver linings and fly. And I think there's something with an adaptability as well about what can I control and what can I not. And maybe that clarity that you speak to, because it just sounds very much about that. Again, this idea of being in the present is not about fixing everything. It's about saying, what do I have a sense of volition over? What can I influence? And what can I let go of?
Yes. Yeah, I think that's really key. And you touched on something earlier, which I think I'd like to come back to, because I think it fits so much with what I teach, in that you were saying about, you know, we get pulled out of the present moment. You know, we are worrying about the future, or we're beating ourselves up about something that happened in the past. And in that stretch of our awareness, the very place that we need to be, which is in the present, we're not there.
Yeah.
Because I'm trying to sort of what if my way to the, you know, the future. Well, what if this happens? And but maybe that, and da da da. Or why did I do that? Or da da da. And we're in the past.
Yeah.
And we're not present. And there's only one reality. It's right now, right here. And the thing is that when we're stressed and tired, we get pulled out of that present. And certainly in the work that I do, I think a huge benefit that comes from meditation is to be able to hold the now, to be here right now fully. And it was interesting. One of my clients said to me, he said, you know, before I learned, this big sort of hotshot finance guy, and he said, you know, before I learned to meditate, I'd be dealing with a client, but there'd be this other voice in my head having this conversation, and I wasn't even fully listening to this person, you know. And he said, it was interesting. Once I learned to meditate, that other voice just went quiet. And then I was really there with that person. But there was all this going on in the background. And it was a really interesting way of describing it.
It is. It's because it makes you less efficient. It makes you less still. And I think that's it. It's these false economies. The last thing I want to ask you about is what is your compass? What's the next challenge? I'm sure this is probably something that sort of, obviously changes over months or years. But, well, what's next for you, Gillian?
Gosh, that's always my challenge, I have to say, is there's no shortage of things to do. There's no shortage of ideas. I'm a little bit bound by the demands on my time and, you know, how many places I can be. I find that my time horizon for evaluating this at the moment seems to be annually, in the sense that Michael, my partner, and I, we sort of take stock of the year, and we have this process of sort of the things that we had on our project list, you know, how did we go, what got done. And then there's a sort of a setting for the year to come of things. And I find at the moment that just seems to be as far out as I can go at the moment, actually. And of course there are, you know, there's things further down, but I'm putting my attention. I think one of the big things that I'm very excited about at the moment is, and it just came out of a sense, there was a word that kept coming to me, and it was charity. And I was like, what is this? And, you know, I'm very passionate about how we support this next generation coming into this world that is demanding. And I think as a mother, you know, it's heightened that. And with my daughter and starting school, when she was at nursery, Michael and I went in and we offered meditation to all of the teachers. And they took this up with great gusto and found it to be incredibly important in the work that they were doing with these little humans. And then I did the same thing recently at Lowy's school. And that has been something that has been incredibly fulfilling to watch. And as, you know, the head teacher has been describing to me, you know, just it's palpable, the effect that that's having in that environment. And that is affecting those children. And I've just this week been talking to another school, which is in the very, very close to Grenfell. And, you know, we're going to do the same thing there. And people are already signing up and for that. And it's a way for us to give back and support and help. You know, I always say it takes a village to raise a child. And these teachers are dealing with so, so much. And if I can start there, you know, that feels like a good place to start. So let's see where that goes. I feel like it's the beginning of something.
Actually, my daughter's school, I wish she came back raving. She's like, you know, again, it's one of these high achieving schools. And she said, you know what? We went in to do yoga when this teacher came. We're all like, oh, you know, shouldn't we be doing more? Like, you know, and she goes, actually, it was so much fun. And she was, we really relaxed into it. So I think, I think getting kids not just to learn, but to think about how they think and how they are in the world. If we can start them young, it's amazing. Yeah. Oh, Gillian, I could talk to you for ages. But listen, I'm sure people listening would love to hear more about you. Where can they find you?
Gosh, I mean, LondonMeditationCentre.com, you know, that's the place, or NewYorkMeditationCentre.com from wherever you are. Those are the two hubs. Mm-hmm. So go to the website and come and meet us and come to an intro talk. Or email me. I would love to hear from you. Thank you. It's just been such a delight to chat.
We have to do this again because I've got a million other questions, but I'm very, you've been so generous with your time. So thank you so much. And
such a pleasure.
Lovely to speak. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, that was Gillian Lounger. And I don't know about you, but, you know, just hearing the tone of her voice, I feel calmer already. I got to say, it was a fascinating discussion. And being able to understand not just what meditation is, but, you know, why to do it, what the benefits are and the specific benefits, and actually the fact that they come so quickly. I think that's what I'm going to really take away from that. So if you enjoyed it, I would really urge you to learn more about Gillian's work. She gave details of her website, London Meditation Center and New York Meditation Center, so you can go and check that out online. And all that remains is that for me to wish you a very healthy, happy, and relaxed body and mind as we go into next week's podcast. Look forward to seeing you then.